2 weeks before the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. What a dishonest word for that noxious bleeding gash into the waters of the Gulf of Mexico. I dreamed of a badly injured fish who had had half his face torn off by some brutal method employed by the practitioners of industrial-scale fishing operations to exploit the world's oceans. The fish had worked himself upon a rock on a craggy shoreline. Holding an eternity of suffering in his one remaining eye, the fish turned to face me. Ever since this dream, the image has lived within me. I carry the fish's suffering, and I bear his dark rage regarding what our species has done to his as well as our home. This complex, mysterious, beguiling, dangerous, sublime, monstrous, and magnificent world we were cast into. My sense of sorrow at times seems unbearable, my rage bottomless. Who will speak for the voiceless? Who will make amends for their suffering? In childhood, I loved this body of water. Loved it as one can love any living thing, which it is. I swam in it, collected jewel-like shells on its beaches of bleached sand, and went deep-sea fishing with my father in its azure waters, wherein I was in awe of its seemingly endless bounty and abundance. Its winds and waves intimated to me the nature of eternity, and the Gulf's living things drew me into the beauty and terrors of the living moment. Approximately 90% of the large fish, tuna, mackerel, in the world's oceans are gone due to overfishing. Oceanographers predict in 50 years' time, the oceans and seas the earth over will be dead. And these are conservative estimates. Much like the denizens of Late Cretaceous, looking dumbly at the sky and barely giving a second thought to that bright, shiny thingy that appeared above, this is a calamity so large in scale and so all-encompassing in its implications that we human beings just can't wrap our minds around it. In fact, by our elevation of willful ignorance and mindless consumerism to a cultural imperative, we human beings acting collectively are the equivalent of the planet decimating Cretaceous comet. I try to resist losing myself in misanthropic rage when I read statistics such as this. Yet I am enraged at the waste, the sheer stupidity, mendacity, and hubris of it all. I want to grab the human race by the lapels and shout, "Stop it! God damn it! Just stop it! How could you destroy something so beautiful and then continue to go through your subcretinous day? What the hell is wrong with you? Didn't anyone ever teach you the meaning of decency?" This is not a political debate. This is a choice between sanity and mass suffering, perhaps even the survival of our species and a mass dial. But listening to the pronouncements of Washington's political class and the mainstream media's ceaseless, shallow, miss-the-point narratives is like eavesdropping on the palaver of a petri dish.
To dust, parted from us. On April 20th, 2010, 205 million gallons of oil began flowing into the Gulf of Mexico. For 3 months, we strongly debated our crippling dependency on oil. But what if the explosion never happened? What would we have done with all that oil? Almost half of it would have been processed into gasoline. Enough fuel for 750,000 cars to drive from New York to L.A. 37 million gallons of the spilled oil would have turned into diesel. That same amount of fuel could keep one semi-truck driving nonstop for 536 years. 16 million gallons would have been converted into jet fuel. That's enough to circle the globe over 3,000 times on a large commercial plane. 10 million gallons of the spill would have been processed into 20,000 tons of plastic. That amount of plastic could make enough milk jugs to fill the inside of the Empire State Building. 6 million gallons would be used for synthetic rubber, creating enough tires to replace all four wheels on every car in Buffalo, New York. The remaining oil has thousands of uses, from heating your house to paving roads to creating the fibers in your sweater. The full environmental consequences of this spill remain unknown. Yet we do know how 205 million gallons of processed oil impacts our world. 15,000 tons of plastic created would never be recycled. 180,000 of the tires created would end up in landfills, and the CO2 emissions created from the use of the oil would be over 1.6 million tons, requiring a forest the size of San Francisco to offset. The 205 million gallons of oil lost in the Gulf is the same amount the United States consumes in less than 7 hours. There is no low-impact solution when oil is involved.
Nobody's home. This mode of being is far removed from the norms of nature and the reveries and attendant sublimations necessary to engage in civic life. Here, ruthlessness and rationalization banish reason. Ambition trumps merit. Expediency pushes aside wisdom, and empty sensation masquerades as experience.
Like interstate travel, the mode of mind of the consumer state propels us forward to the next empty agenda, the next perfunctory task, the next meaningless purchase.
But depression slows us down, inducing us to feel the grief inherent in our alienation, to cease the incessant, habitual hurtling forward and striving upward, to stop and investigate the mysteries of our hearts, to feel the sadness of the suffering earth. I can't go on. I'll go on, Samuel Beckett. We must slow down. We are destroying our planet and her exquisite, irreplaceable creatures, as well as our own sanity.
Gila was a girl who spent most of her time in her little orange canoe on a river. The water was smooth and peaceful, and so was the sky. With her paddles resting, Gila bathed in the silent light of her balmy Pleiades. One day, Gila leaned over the edge of her little orange canoe to observe the reflections of trees, birds, and her own self on the water surface. A salmon jumped up from the river and gave Gila a kiss. With a salmon taste on her lips, she leaned again, waiting in suspense. Sure enough, it wasn't long before the shiny pink fish started to leap all around her little orange canoe. And being so excited, Gila too jumped up and down, and losing her balance, she fell into the water. Splash! Feeling adopted by the salmon family, Gila left behind her little orange canoe and went diving in the river. She saw salmon life underwater was magnificent. The river was full of skylight radiance as the sun rays dispersed in its depths. Gila's play days went on and on until it became obvious that the river was becoming shallower and shallower. Her little orange canoe became stranded. There was just enough water so the salmon could breathe, but not swim. Soon the riverbed dried out completely and Gila lost her salmon family. In tears, Gila ran home. "Mama," she screamed, "I'm getting thirsty and hungry. Where is our river?" Her mom pointed to a plastic bottle on the table and said, "There it is." Gila fell on her knees and bent over to the floor, her wet face in her hands. "Oh no, that is not our river, Mama." As you played, Gila, a corporation has poured all of your river's water into plastic bottles. They are selling our bottle river back to us. Having lost our river, we've lost our living, and we have no money to buy this water. Listening to her mother's words, Gila's throat became dry. "You have to stop crying," said her mother, "to preserve as much fluid in your body as possible. Make this bottle of water last us, or you can take only a sip at a time," she warned. In the beginning, Gila listened to her mother. She remained calm in cool places. This is how she and her mom survived the little water they had until the rainy seasons arrived. Even though the rain itself belonged to the corporation, Gila's mom was able to collect some rainwater in the containers she hid on the rooftop of their little cob house. She could only do this at night when the corporation inspectors were not around. Gila gulped this water and some strength returned to her. Revived, she decided to go to see if the riverbed had filled up. She was missing her little orange canoe and the salmon family. When she arrived at her favorite river, her heart sank. Where once the river used to be, she could see a ton of empty plastic bottles.
Salesmen of the Eternal Big Happy are just that, salesmen. One is required to respond to the intoxication of the sales pitch and not to question the condition of their heart. The commercial come-ons insist that the heart's grief and a lost soul's emptiness and panic can be fixed by some new bright and shiny, a new appliance, therapy, hope and change, by the incessant promotion of the gospels of the hyper-capitalist sects of happiness uber alles. The implicit message imparted is suffering is a character flaw that can be mitigated, elevated, even redeemed by consumerism, antidepressants, acquiring a positive attitude, all the uttered homilies and donned vestments of the consumer state. The foundation of all mental illness is the unwillingness to experience legitimate suffering. Oh, man. What kind of a miserable malcontent would resist changing this social milieu and personal mode of being, sitting stuck in traffic, eating high-fat, low-quality food from a drive-through window, languishing in a cubicle, stranded in a low-benefits, little-chance-of-advancement job, until, of course, the job is outsourced, waddling around the mall, clad in off-the-rack sweatshop's own clothing, dozing off in front of the TV with Cheeto crumbs stippled in the folds of your jacket. Ain't this the life, or what? We must preserve the death styles of empire. Excuse my sense of fatalism. At this point, the system is too far gone to be redeemed. It is in the process a systemic breakdown. Although this is not as awful as it sounds, for one must let go and let the natural process of decay take over. When the rot is this advanced, at best what you have is culture as a compost heap. Yet that doesn't mean in times of decay there cannot be meaning and beauty, because life itself becomes vivid and alive in contrast to the extant ugliness. Without decay, there is no change. The world would be as pointless as paradise. If you wish to find the future forest, look to the humus upon its floor. The future is decay, and decay is the future. The old ego must sing even within the compost heap of its own putrefied concepts. And as it does, it must sing of its sorrows and the sorrows of the earth, singing like the severed head of Orpheus floating to Lesbos. Arias of compost sing of new understandings, but you cannot skip the singing school of grief. Frank O'Hara suggests in times of crisis, we must all decide again and again whom we love. Things are going to work out, but not in ways we can predict. If these Confederate ghosts could shout through the prison of their enshrinement, they would call out to us, "Don't believe it. Having seen the meaningless waste of war, we know now that we would have chosen to live out our lives breathing in the humid Georgia air, having our troubles softened by the sight of dappled light filtered through pine needles, and being lulled to sleep at night by the sounds of crickets and cicada. Don't believe the lie as we did that dying in a rich man's war is a virtue. Don't buy into the fraud that working all your life for a greedy few is a sound way to proceed through the fleeting and finite years of your time upon this earth." Thank you.
left, no love, no.
From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors, so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.